Cheers, ladies and gentlemen.
Cheers.
Cheers.
I feel like that's part of the reason that he's remembered now, actually. Because I feel like, if anything, if he had been writing stuff more conventional, he probably would have just sort of faded into obscurity.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Clink.
Clink.
Welcome to Pour Me a Mozart. I'm your host, Asia, and with me today is Chris, and we are drinking to Peroni's and Berlioz's Herald in Italy. So welcome, Chris. Thank you for being here with me.
Thank you for having me.
And it's good to see you again.
It's good to see you too. It's been like 7 years almost, hasn't it?
I know. It's crazy to think it was that long ago. It feels like that's how long we've been in quarantine. Will you start off with your 2-minute personal history?
All right, let's see. Well, so I'm Chris Lowry. I'm a viola player, a composer, an audio engineer, and I don't know, multi-instrumentalist, percussionist, mandolinist, banjoist. Is that a word?
It is now.
It is now. And I live in Nashville, Tennessee. Split my time between Nashville, Baton Rouge, Louisiana, Amarillo, Texas, and I'm occasionally down in Mexico as well for teaching, although that all that has been canceled this summer, but as has everything else.
Yes.
But I'm from Nashville originally, went to Vanderbilt for my undergrad, then did both my master's and doctorate at LSU, which is where I know Asia, and to Mexico after that, and then moved back to Nashville and have been trying to figure out my life ever since. Primarily playing recording sessions in Nashville for video game and film scores, and playing in the Amarillo Symphony and in the Baton Rouge Symphony, and composing whenever I have a free minute, which has been a lot these days.
Yeah.
And I guess that just about does it.
Okay. You actually did totally fine on time, just so you know.
Okay, good.
Let's talk a little bit about your composition, because pre-COVID, you were traveling a lot for, like, you left this out of your little bio, but you've had pieces premiered in Carnegie Hall.
That's true, yeah. I've had 2 pieces premiered in Carnegie and 1 piece premiered in Walt Disney Hall. And both all of those are actually from the same company, this company, World Projects. They had a composition contest that I won 2 years in a row, and that's how I got those premieres. Then after that, they added me to their roster of composers to commission. So they commissioned me for a piece for Carnegie in 2018. Then the past 2 years, I've had commissions for premiere in the Chicago Symphony Hall, but both of those have been canceled. One because they were on strike, and this year because of COVID, of course.
Someday.
So, yeah, someday they'll happen, I hope. But it's been really nice getting those kinds of opportunities and, you know, getting music out there that hopefully people enjoy hearing, and it seems people enjoy playing, so.
Yeah, I have a confession. Do you remember when we were in string rep class together with Dennis?
Yes.
And he gave us this assignment at the end of the semester.
Yeah,
to
I know exactly
piece.
Where you're going.
Yeah. Yeah. And, oh my gosh, I brought, like, the dumbest piece.
I actually don't remember what you brought.
I think it was the Beethoven Septet, and Dennis, after I played it, was kind of like, everyone's heard that before. And I was like, well, I hadn't.
Honestly,
Dennis has heard everything before.
Dennis has heard everything, and I don't feel like the Beethoven is that well known.
Well, thank you.
I mean, they played it at LSU, I guess, the year after you left, but faculty and students. So you can take credit for that one, I guess.
Totally. But I remember you just, like, raised your hand, and you're like, can I bring something I wrote? And I was like, oh, God.
Yeah, I could feel the oh, God from, like, everyone in the room.
But then you played a recording of your music, and I was like, this is amazing.
Like, thank you. I appreciate
it. It was really nice. And I remember you being like, well, I started writing music because there's not a lot of tonal stuff written for viola, and so I wanted to write music that sounds good for viola. And I was like, okay. I feel that.
I still feel that way. I'm not writing as tonal as I used to most of the time, but I'm still striving for, you know, accessibility.
Yeah, I mean, accessibility for listeners, I think, is almost more important than for players, because, like, we'll figure it out.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of equally important, but it's true. Like, I mean, so much of what's written for the viola is so obscure just because our repertoire is so young. that we've had to be kind of more creative about problem solving, because a lot of people don't play the viola and they are writing for it. And so, you know, sometimes if you have a personal relationship with the composer, you can ask them to change some things or whatever. But other times it's just a fun challenge to figure things out.
Yeah. I realize I should have asked my other viola guests on here. So you're the first to get this question. But there's, what is it, three big viola concertos that you play for auditions?
Yeah, and there's plenty more now that are, that should be considered just a standard, but for some reason, everyone, like, you look at an audition list and it's like, violinists, you know, play any standard concerto from the Romantic era or whatever.
Right.
Cellists, it's the same thing. And then violists, it's like, play either the Walton, the Bartok, or the Hindemith.
So which of those three big concertos is your favorite?
The Walton.
The Walton?
By far, yeah.
I should have known that.
Well, and I've played the Hindemith. I've played the first movement several times, not with orchestra, but just played it with piano several times. And I've sort of studied the rest of it. And I really should revisit it, because it's a great piece. But I've played the Bartok with orchestra twice, and I played the Walton with orchestra twice. And there's just something, there's something in the virtuosity of the Bartok that's a lot more fun, because you can kind of just, you can fake a lot of it and no one really notices. I can't believe I just said that, but it's true.
it's fine, and
the audience won't know the difference, and they'll still be impressed because, hey, fast flying fingers. Whereas the Walton is a lot more austere and a lot more just deep. And I like that better, but it definitely is a harder piece to sell.
What would you do if you weren't a musician?
You know, it's really hard to imagine doing anything else, but if I had to do anything else, I've always been interested in entomology, which is study of insects. And you've probably figured out by some of my bug pictures.
Oh my God, Chris, sometimes you put spiders on Facebook and
I know.
Ruins my day.
You're not the first person to tell me that. I've tried to slow that down a little bit, but
there needs to be a filter. Like, I don't want to see these, and then you can post them freely, but like, I would like
I wonder if I can like put a trigger warning, like censor kind of thing on it, to where you have to click on it to see it.
That'd be amazing.
but yeah, no, I've always been interested in insects, ever since I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And, I don't know. It's something that I've wanted to study, but I don't want to go back to school for.
Okay. You posted about something on Facebook a while ago that you were like, I can't really talk about this. And I asked you about it pre-recording, and you said, I can talk a little bit about it, but you met someone super cool.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm not at liberty to discuss much about many of our recording sessions, because a lot of what we do, we sign non-disclosure agreements for. Because a lot of times we record soundtracks for games before the games have even been announced as coming out. So some of what we've done even this year, like I can't talk about anything we've done this year, but we've recorded some major, major titles.
That's
we've
exciting.
done stuff in the past like Call of Duty and, oh man, what can I talk about?
Okay, there's a new Paper Mario game out.
We didn't do that.
Okay.
No, the only Nintendo thing we did was this one that you were talking about when Koji Kondo came in. For those who don't know, Koji Kondo is the composer, the original composer for Mario, for Zelda, and I think he composed for some of the Star Fox series, but I don't think he composed the original one. But he, most of the video game themes you think of, besides Final Fantasy and stuff like that, that he is responsible for them. They never tell us ahead of time what we're recording. So you accept the session, you show up, you sit down. And this was a different session than usual because there were sound baffles everywhere, like different microphones, like everything was like super, super done up. And I sit down and the music composer says, Kondo-san. I'm like, oh my God. And I look in the control room and there he is. And he walks out into the tracking room and introduces himself. And that's all I can tell you.
That's so cool. And you have a picture with him, which is super cool.
Yeah. I never get starstruck. Like, I'm usually fine meeting people that are famous. I fangirled so hard.
Did you do anything embarrassing?
Yeah, kind of.
What did you do?
I went up and I was like, hi, I like Mario. And that was like all I could say.
That's amazing.
So hopefully within a year or year and a half, I'll be able to finally talk about the project.
I can't wait.
Yeah, me same, because it's really hard to keep these kinds of secrets.
I bet. But. What is your favorite snack?
So snacks, I don't know. It depends. I've been eating a lot of pretzels. I just like pretzels a lot in pretty much any form.
Are you a Dax person?
I don't know.
Oh, they're like huge in the Midwest.
I don't think I've ever had them.
Dots pretzels. Oh, yeah. They're great. Oh, find them.
I'll have to find them. Mm-hmm. I really like those buffalo wing flavored ones.
Oh, yeah.
They're like the little pretzel nuggets or something. I think they're Snyder's or something. And they're,
oh, that sounds good.
I love those. But besides that, I really like pickles. I've been like obsessed with finding like the perfect dill pickle without having to figure out how to make it myself. Which apparently is not that hard, so I probably should just learn how to make it.
Yeah. What is your go-to drink?
Beer all the way. Actually, it depends. Usually beer, and as my tastes have matured, I've gotten to be more in the same way. Like, I like a beer that kicks you in the mouth, like something either really, really hoppy or really, really malty, and I'm not real big on stuff in between. Big into IPAs, into stouts, and into the Belgian triples and quadruples. But then sometimes I like to drink rye whiskeys and stuff. But I still think probably above all else, it's mostly the hoppy beers that I migrate towards.
Yeah. So you actually suggested the drink for tonight.
Yeah.
You're drinking Peroni, which is an Italian beer. I looked up a few things about it, but if you would like to say something.
Well, I don't know much about it other than it's the only Italian beer I ever see imported to the States. I'm sure there are others, but like, you go to Walmart, they're going to have Peroni, and they won't have anything else from Italy. And I had gotten it a long time ago just to try it, and I remember not particularly liking it that much. And so I was hesitant to suggest it, but since it was just like, well, we're talking about Harold in Italy, let's find an Italian drink. And I'm not big into wine, so I felt this would be appropriate. And I actually drank one a little bit earlier just to like remind myself what it tasted like. And I like it a lot better now than I used to.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like, it's a beer.
Yeah. It's just like middle of the road, like a typical lager.
Yeah.
Like it's almost, it's so light. It's almost a Pilsner. It's like a Pilsner, but I don't hate it.
Let's talk about an ale versus a lager. When I first started working in the restaurant industry, this confused the crap out of me. So lagers are brewed using bottom fermenting strains of yeast at colder temperatures, and ales are brewed with a top fermenting yeast at warmer temperatures. And I always thought that meant that lagers were really heavy, but that's not true. Like, this is a pretty light beer, but ales can also be pretty light. So it's kind of like, what does it even really mean for taste?
I don't know, honestly. Like, I mean, when I taste a lager versus an ale, yeah, I guess I can usually tell the difference. Like, I can usually tell it's one versus the other, but I've never really thought about the like brewing process and what that actually means.
Yeah.
And basically what you just described is all I knew about the differences between them anyway. So,
I mean, same. I never remember which way it goes. Yeah. I mean, maybe lagers tend to be a little lighter in color, but I think there's such a big flavor profile now in beers that it doesn't really make a huge difference.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, so I Googled it. This is Italy's number one premium beer. It is a crisp, refreshing lager that exudes Italian style. I don't know, man. It just kind of tastes like a beer to me. Yeah.
I mean, I will give them that. It is very refreshing.
It is. They're not wrong, but like Italian style.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really know. Like, I mean, if we're honest, when you think of Italy, you don't think of beer.
Yeah, that's fair. Shall we talk a little bit about Berlioz?
Sure.
Okay, so Berlioz made his first appearance on this podcast on season 1, episode 1 with Shane Hawley. Highly recommend listening to that. Shane's a comedian, super fun to listen to. I was really awkward and nervous because I hadn't done a podcast before, so it's just a good time all around. But I did do a lot of research and talked a lot about Berlioz there. I will also confess that I don't remember what I said on that episode. So here's a little bit, maybe some of the same information. Berlioz was born December 11th, 1803, and died on March 8th, 1869. He was the oldest son of, I don't know how many, this time my research came from Wikipedia, that's all I got. His father was a doctor, and Berlioz was expected to go into medicine, but defied his family by going into music instead. He was an independent thinker and didn't want to follow rules or formulas. And for that reason, maybe it's good he didn't go into medicine. In 1830, he won France's top music prize, the Prix de Rome. That's my French accent right there.
It's great. It's great.
Thank you. Due to moderating his personal style to conform to what he thought people wanted. But he continued after that, ignoring convention. And obviously, opinions about his writing were divided.
They still are.
Yeah, I mean, he wrote some great music, but the critics say there's no sort of structure or form, which, you know, is kind of true. But does that make it bad? I don't think so.
No, I don't think so either. It's interesting because I remember talking about him in undergrad as him being basically self-taught, which is kind of beyond me. I don't think he was entirely self-taught, but I think for a long time, you know, he had written a lot of stuff without any guidance.
I think he
went
to the Paris Conservatory, but kind of ignored a lot of things he did there.
Yeah, and I mean, I feel like that's part of the reason that that he's remembered now, actually. Because I feel like, if anything, if he had been writing stuff more conventional, he probably would have just sort of faded into obscurity. Like, imagine Symphonie Fantastique, like, normal. I mean, there's some stuff in Symphonie Fantastique that I would like to take some white out to, but, you know, like, it's still, you know, there's a reason that it's as famous as it is, and I think it's great.
Harold in Italy, it's his Opus 16. It's a symphony with solo viola, which is also very much against convention.
Yep.
It was written in 1834, and Paganini, the very famous Paganini, had just acquired the Stradivarius viola and said, "I have no suitable music. Would you like to write a solo for viola? You are the only one I can trust for this task." Which Paganini turned out to not be happy with what Berlioz wrote. When he saw all the rests in the viola part, he had expected to, you know, play most of the time, like you would for a standard concerto, but Berlioz, being Berlioz, was like, no, I'm gonna do this my way. This is more for orchestra, and you're like a little twinkly bit on top of it.
Yeah, there's one of my favorite viola jokes is this one that literally just says, "What's the world's longest viola joke?" Harold in Italy. And I, like, honestly, I know it's probably supposed to just be a joke in the sense that it's a long piece written for the viola, but it actually is interesting because it's like 45 minutes long or something. And I mean, the viola plays for about 15% of that maybe. And so, I mean, otherwise you're just awkwardly standing up there, or sitting or whatever. I don't know.
So there's actually something in the score about what the solo violist is supposed to do.
The walking off stage thing.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert.
Dang it.
Yeah. We'll get to that.
So Berlioz and Paganini parted, and Paganini was disappointed. But then, after he heard the premiere, or was it the premiere, or like another performance after that?
I think it was another performance. I think it was like 4 years after the premiere.
Yeah, he was like, "I love this." It's like, dude, make up your mind.
Yeah, apparently he like followed, like when Berlioz went out to take the bow, like Paganini jumped up on stage or something and like got on his knees and like kissed his hand. Apologized for not playing it and saying, "This is the greatest thing ever. I will play it." And then gave him like 20,000 francs or something. Like, yeah.
Whatever, man. After the premiere, also, Berlioz decided to be the only person who would conduct his own music. Wikipedia didn't expand on that, but I'm just wondering, like, what?
I'm guessing it didn't go particularly well.
That's my guess, too. I'm just wondering it won't, in what way.
Yeah, I don't know. I'd be curious. I read that, too, and I'd like to look into that more and see if there's any, like, documentation on any of that stuff.
So just a couple more things about this piece. The mood is inspired by a poem written by Lord Byron, who is George Gordon Byron, 6th Baron Byron. I'm not sure if that's his entire name. The poem is called Child Harold Pilgrimage. And from what I gather, Harold actually refers to a person, not like, because of the spelling, it's not like the Harold angel, where you're like heralding a thing. It's like, "Hi, my name is Harold."
Yeah, that's my understanding. I've actually never really looked into the actual poem.
It's long and not originally written in English. It's one of those, at least I don't think so. Maybe it is. Maybe I'm wrong about that. You can look at, listeners, you can look it up on Wikipedia and be like, I know more than you now. But it's four stanzas long or something like that. There was another name for them, and it's long form. Did I say iambic pentameter already?
No, you didn't. But...
okay. And I think of the four sections, the last one is where Harold is actually in Italy. So this is really not about the whole poem. It's about...
should be Harold's journey to Italy.
You don't think this sounds like him being in Italy?
I don't know. It's.
Let's talk a little bit about the orchestration.
I have it pulled up here. So it calls for two flutes, and the second doubles piccolo, two oboes, first doubles English horn. I'm not sure why it's the first instead of the second, but anyway. Two clarinets in C and A, four bassoons, a little bottom heavy there. Four horns, two cornets, two trumpets, three trombones, tuba, timpani, cymbals, triangle, two tambourines, harp.
Wait a second. Tambourine is the one that goes like...
Yeah.
Okay. And then I think I talked over you when you said harp and strings.
That was a good tambourine imitation, by the way.
Thank you. Why on earth would you ever need two of them?
I've actually written for two tambourines in a piece as well.
Chris, explain yourself.
Different pitches. The jingles have different pitches. I didn't specify what material I wanted, but I have like 10 tambourines in my closet at home. And I have some with nickel jingles, some with steel, some with brass. They all sound different. So.
All right, well.
So there's a reason, but.
I learned something new today.
But it is a little overkill in an orchestral situation. But
a little bit.
Berlioz is all about that overkill.
He is. And actually, when you start reading the orchestration, it's like, oh, this is pretty normal. Wait, four bassoons? Like...
yeah. Yeah, this is a little more standard than a lot of what I've seen from him.
Oh, have you ever performed this?
No, I haven't. It's been on my list. I've actually tried... I've mentioned it to several conductors to try to get people interested in it, but, you know... There's two problems. No one wants to program this piece. No one wants to program a viola soloist. So there is actually a piano transcription of the orchestra part that Liszt did. But I don't know why you would ever play it, because the pianist plays for 45 minutes and then you just sit there and don't play for most of it. Here it actually says, yeah, Liszt prepared a piano transcription with viola accompaniment.
Amazing. So actually at the beginning of the score, it says that the... I'm not really sure how this is supposed to work, but it says that the violist should be away from the orchestra and near the audience, but also close to the harp.
Right. I'm not sure how people normally do this. I've seen a few videos of, like, I know Thomas Tiet recorded it, I think, last year or maybe 2 years ago, and he posted some pictures of it, and he was on stage for most of it, I think, but he was out in... like in the balcony or something of the audience for like the last part of this thing. I don't remember exactly, but I have another friend who played it recently and posted a picture from out in the audience right before he played that solo.
Okay.
So I guess you have to walk around and be awkward.
Yeah. I saw it once when the Minnesota Orchestra played it. And that was actually the only time I've ever heard this piece before I started preparing for this recording.
Right. I've still never heard it live. So that's once more than I have.
Tom Turner was the principal at the time. So he played the mm-hmm. solo. And I have this vivid memory of him walking down the aisle to like his shoulders were going and he was being all like, I can say ass on my own podcast, badass about it. And then listening to it again, I was like, when did he do that? Because it's not really, like, that doesn't really fit until the fourth movement. And was he really not on stage? Or was he on stage and then left and I didn't notice? Like,
that's probably what it was. I don't know. I feel like everyone's trying to find a good solution for how to make it work and be cheeky, but also not be distract from the actual musical content.
Yeah. In any case, it is in the notes that the violist should maybe not be... on stage. But shall we dive into the first movement and hear Harold's theme?
Sure.
And some sounds lovely great. Viola playing. This is the Czech Philharmonic, and are you familiar with Lubomir Mali?
I am not.
Well, that's the soloist.
All right, perfect. It's funny. This is the excerpt I always think of. Like, it's the part that always comes to my mind when I think of this piece. And it's the perfect example of good writing for the viola, because it's low, it's like mid to low range stuff, nice big viola sound. And that's basically the only time in the whole piece that you get to do that much of that, I think, anyway.
Yeah, so. With the good orchestration behind it, because a lot of times, this recording did a really good job of making the viola stand out, but there are some places where, like, the French horns are doubling the viola. The viola can't compete with that.
No, definitely not. Like, and then it's up to the recording engineer to make sure they've mic'd the viola well, otherwise.
Yeah, and I feel like this recording did, but even so, it's like, there's also so much other stuff happening that it just didn't.
Yeah.
It didn't cut through. But it's lovely. A nice thing. I actually kind of want to try playing that on the viola.
It feels good to play. And it's also, as I was telling you before we started recording, this is, I think, the only excerpt that you ever see on an excerpt list for an orchestra audition. And it's not commonly asked for. It would only be asked for a principal audition. But it was asked for, actually, like, you remember the YouTube symphony a few years back?
Yeah. When that?
It was a requirement for principal, or maybe for the entire section, but I think it was mainly for consideration for title chair for that.
Okay.
And there was a video, the Sydney Symphony, I guess, did a series of master classes on the excerpts. And so Roger Benedict, their principal violist, did a really great video that, have you seen those Shreds videos? Like, there's these videos with, like, you see, like, Zuckerman or Perlman playing something, but somebody has overdubbed themselves playing really badly instead. And so somebody did that with Roger's video. Unfortunately, it's not on YouTube anymore. I guess it was offensive, but
I mean, if it was me, I would want that taken down.
Yeah, me too, to be fair. But it was hysterical.
I
know that has nothing to do with really what we're talking about, but
no,
just
okay.
It's what I think of every single time.
So one of the things that I read about this is that it's not particularly virtuosic for the viola.
Right.
And I think this next part is maybe some of the most complicated stuff that the viola has to do in the entire piece. Coordinating with the harp on its own has to
be
complicated.
Yeah, there's some difficult ensemble stuff. And also, it doesn't actually go all that high for, like, today's standards. It goes up to a high B, which would be in, I guess, fifth or sixth position, which is not too bad. But for the time period, that's pretty crazy, because no one wrote for the viola that way. Like, the only thing I can think of, and I had to look up the date that it was written, is Schubert's Trout Quintet, which was written in 1819. The viola part there, since it's written for, you know, it's a string quartet with piano, but it's violin, viola, cello, and bass. So the cello is basically playing a viola part the whole time, and the bass is playing a cello part, a simplified cello part at that. But the viola part really feels like a second violin part, and there's one high B in there that always feels super awkward to play, just because you get in the mindset of being like, I am playing, like, the end of the classical period, early romantic period music, and something switches off in your brain about, like, typical viola playing.
Yeah.
And so notes like that all of a sudden are like, oh crap, that's high, but it's not, it's not actually. So it's really interesting to see this, because, I mean, in orchestral writing, generally people still weren't writing this way, and really until closer to the 1900s.
Yeah, which this is still like 70 years away from.
Yeah, exactly. So for that, I mean, obviously he was considering Paganini when he wrote it. it, but I mean, even Paganini, like, he didn't write that much for the viola, but to be fair, Paganini also did write a sonata for his viola, sonata for the grand viola, and it goes up like an octave and a half or something higher than that high B, and that's ridiculous. But
I'm unfamiliar with this piece. I'll have to check that out.
Elias actually played it with us in LSU. I guess it was my second year. Yeah, you had just graduated. So, yeah.
Okay.
Never mind. But, yeah, it's quite a piece. Yeah, it was great. It was really, really great.
I forgot to mention at the beginning of talking about the first movement, but this is Harold in the Mountains. So this is, I thought this was interesting, the description, scenes of melancholy, happiness, and joy. But I guess it starts adagio and then gets allegro. So, and this is the longest movement at 15 minutes long. So shall we hear some of the allegro?
Let's do it.
Let's do it. That's the introduction of the second theme, which Wikipedia said the viola introduces that, but no.
Yeah, no, not really.
It's the violins. But sure, Wikipedia, you can be right there. The viola has the most active part in the first movement.
Mm-hmm.
And then the rest of it is really basically just a symphony.
Yeah.
Which, is this the point where if the violist left the stage that would happen?
You know what? I'm not really sure. I should know, but I don't.
Well, it could also be a thing, like, everyone does it a little differently, because everyone's
probably
trying to
problem
solve.
Yeah, true. And everyone's trying to problem solve differently than the previous person, so.
Yeah, gotta make it innovative.
Yeah.
So, the second movement is Procession of Pilgrims Singing the Evening Hymn. And this is about 8.5 minutes long. And the tempo is marked allegretto. I think I shared these excerpts with Chris before we started recording. And I said, this is maybe where the harp is more important than the viola. But also, let me know if this reminds you of anything from Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Maybe a loose connection. Are you on the same page with me or no?
I honestly no, but okay. I've been talking about, Casey and I have been talking about watching Monty Python again for a long time, and I will be listening out for that.
Okay, so it reminds me, because it's Pilgrims and the Evening Hymn, it reminds me of it's loose, but it reminds me of the monks when they're singing Piesu Domine, and that's like the horns, but then the harp is the thunk.
Yeah, okay, that's fair. I get it.
It's maybe a stretch, but it entertained me when I was listening to it earlier.
Man, I got that part of the movie stuck in my head recently. I think I was at a church service or something, and
oh gosh,
there was a chant that just reminded me of it, and I just could not stop laughing.
I also brought that moment up in my episode about Fauré's Requiem.
That's fair. Actually, that may have been what reminded me of it.
Yeah.
Because I played that twice last year. That, okay. That's one of my favorite pieces of all time, by the way. But also,
it's beautiful.
That's viola candy right there.
True.
But yeah, that was probably what it was, because there's a lot of chants in that. But
yeah.
Anyway.
And there's even a Piesu.
Yes.
So honey, let's get to actual thematic material from this movement. I bookended this with Cool Rhythm. There's this theme that happens many times at the beginning in different sections and whatnot, but I chose where the violas introduce the theme. Well, they don't introduce it, but where the violas play the theme. And the Cool Rhythm, that's it's 4-3-3-3-3-2. So da 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 da. And just, I don't know. I like it. Wanted to give you all a ear heads up. I'm gonna stop talking.
And ears up. You know what that reminds me of?
What?
The third movement of Dvorak 9, the New World Symphony. That at the end, the violas do that. They're playing like groups of six, and then they have to jump from a group of six to a group of five to a group of four to a group of three, two, and then
And then don't the seconds have to catch that?
Yeah, which sucks because it's never together.
No, I remember I've played it. There was one year I played it three times, and I played it twice with a community orchestra and once with a regional orchestra, and two times I was playing first violin, but the third time I had to play second, and I remember the first two times just being like, that's not my problem, and then when I was playing second, I was like, oh, crap.
Oh, man. It's, yeah. Every time I play it, every time I'm principal and I play it, that's one of those times where I'm like, head bobbing big time to like try to keep the section together because it is never together.
Yeah, I was principal when I played second and I was just like, oh dear.
Yeah.
Scary little catch.
There's
right there.
there's some great viola moments in that symphony and that is not one of them.
No, it's just terrifying. So in the second movement, I think the viola solo doesn't happen. Well, I guess it's pretty early in the movement, but like a minute and a half in is the first time that you hear the solo viola. And the solo viola brings back the adagio theme from the first movement.
Yeah, this is one thing that I enjoy. You know, he defies convention, but he still uses enough of like these leitmotifs or whatever, the theme that this is clearly an important theme because it's come back multiple times. Mm-hmm. You know, this is Harold or whatever, right? So I'm glad he at least does that because it gives you something, even not from the academic standpoint, just from the standpoint of the listener, it gives you something to latch onto that you're like, oh yeah, I remember that this happened and that it's important for some reason or another.
Yeah, it's like, hi, I'm Harold.
Exactly.
So I couldn't help myself. I usually don't pick as many long excerpts from movements, but this is my fourth excerpt from the second movement because this arpeggio part is just so cool. You look like you have something to say.
No. I remember the excerpt. Excited. Yeah, this is my favorite excerpt too.
So this is labeled in the score Canto Religioso, and it's, I mean, if you believe in religion, this is maybe a religious experience.
Yeah, the chord progression definitely, like, we were talking about this before we started recording, too, that it kind of, like, sounds a little bit like Sibelius's Finlandia a little bit, which, of course, has well, I guess it was originally Sibelius's melody, but that melody in the middle that became the hymn, Be Still My Soul, it reminds me of that. There's this kind of, I mean, the religious experience of it. The chords go in a way that you don't expect them to, but then when they happen, it makes sense and you're like, oh yeah, that has kind of a church music kind of feel to it. You picture it being played on an organ or something.
And it's, it like makes your heart skip a beat. It's just so beautiful.
Yeah, it really
is. I love it. And I just, arpeggios on the violin or viola, or cello too, I suppose. There's something about it. It's like in Mendelssohn's Violin Concerto. In the first movement, that
yeah,
that cadenza, like the whole piece is basically over for me at that moment. The third movement is Serenade of, oh, I meant to look up how to pronounce this. Serenade of an Abruzzi, 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 mountaineer.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know either. But it's a serenade of a mountaineer to his sweetheart, which is, you know, I was writing all this down, not connecting any dots before because I'm a good scholar. But this is a weird serenade, not gonna lie. It's a scherzo. The tempo is allegro assai, and Wikipedia described it as Beethoven-esque in the scherzo, which I can see. But they're like, if I heard this on one of those needle drop tests, there's no way I'd be like, that's Beethoven. But this is the shortest movement at about 6.5 minutes long, and because I realized there was already a lot of musical content at this point, we're just gonna hear the scherzo theme and the trio theme.
Sounds good.
And a bit of Star Wars. Peppy, I think, for Beethoven. There isn't that, like, deep despair.
No, I mean, I see what they mean, but yeah, no, it's too jocular. The image that comes to my head is actually, it doesn't sound anything like this, actually, but it reminds me of being in the market in Ocarina of Time.
Market. Actually, I see, like, Aladdin, maybe.
Okay, fair.
Like, Disney's Aladdin.
Right. Yeah, it's got a lot of... I don't know. I feel like a lot of composers have kind of used that same sort of scherzando kind of idea or pastoral. It almost sounds like something on the countryside or something, you know, it's just, which I guess is kind of what he was going for. But yeah.
I suppose, but that's really how you're going to serenade your sweetheart? Okay.
Probably not my choice, but.
No, not mine either. So the trio, I chose not the beginning of the trio because I thought this part leading into the theme, the trio theme and the horns, sounded a bit Star Wars-esque, which maybe this is less of a stretch than my Monty Python and the Holy Grail. But it's still a bit of a stretch.
Yeah, I hear what you mean.
Easily could go into... why can't I remember how Star Wars goes? Oh, wait. Copyright. Probably shouldn't sing it anymore.
Yeah, I was about to say. but it definitely has a little bit of, like, kind of the John Williams-esque, like, the sequence of how the chords move and then move down a step.
Yeah.
Like, it definitely, like, if you slow that down, maybe take out the double reeds, give it to the flute, and have, like, the celesta playing something underneath in it, it's totally John Williams. And then the horn even comes in afterward with the melodies. Yes. It's like, that's John Williams.
Absolutely. I wonder where he got his inspiration.
From everyone.
From everyone, yeah, literally everyone.
Yeah.
A well-educated man is what I say about him.
Yes, for sure.
Right after that, the viola comes in with, again, the theme from the first movement, the adagio theme that we heard come in the second movement, shows up in every single movement. The fourth movement, again, I meant to look up how to pronounce these words and I didn't. It's the Brigands Orgies.
Yeah.
Reminiscence of the preceding scenes. Barely was in his orgies, man.
I know. He lived an exciting life.
Apparently. Or in his mind/opium trips. But this is another long movement. It's around 12 minutes and 40 seconds, and it's Allegro Frenetico. And I have to confess, this is probably my favorite movement.
That's fair.
It's exciting. It actually, I told Chris, I was listening in my car, and it the end of the third movement going into the fourth movement actually made me jump, and I had to, like, collect myself and then start it over. But it takes you by surprise, so if you're listening through, just don't let the third movement lull you to sleep, I guess. This is not the beginning, but this is the connecting material that happens in the beginning part. There's some new material that's introduced right away, and then Berlioz brings back themes from each of the preceding movements, which is reminiscence of the preceding scenes. It's very obvious. You'll hear it. So here's what the connecting material is. one continues on into something else. Most of the other little interjections are pretty short.
Yeah, this is the most Berliosian sounding to me thus far in terms of like what you expect to hear from him. Mm-hmm. There's something about the way he uses chromatic scales or even like in sixths that are just moving both up and down that it just kind of gives it away, because he does that a lot in Symphony Fantastique. He does it in his overture to Beatrice and Benedict, which I also highly recommend listening to. That's mm-hmm. a great, great mm-hmm. piece. And so like just hearing that, it's just like, oh yeah, that's him. Good old Hector.
Good old Hector. And here's good old Hector maybe imitating some Tchaikovsky. Oh, the horns in harmony like that at the end is just like, give me more.
Yeah, and that whole four against three thing, you're right. It's like you say, it's very Tchaikovsky, and it's always the building up to the climax stuff that he does in like a lot of his pieces. Like it's all over the Nutcracker and Swan Lake. I guess all of his ballet stuff in particular, where it's just like, you know, the strings are playing filigree. Except if it were Tchaikovsky, it would be three octaves higher in the first violin and double in every octave imaginable. But and then the low brass doing that like three against four thing against it, which is just, you know, he does it in every possible chord that could possibly relate to the previous one. Just, you know, build up more.
Oh, yeah, trying to cycle through as many times as possible. Yeah, you're right. If it was Tchaikovsky, that part would be like 12 minutes long in and of itself.
And it would repeat again later.
It would, yes.
Like note for note. And don't get me wrong, I love Tchaikovsky, but man, brevity was not his strong suit.
No. So I really had to stop myself from sharing more from this piece. It's an incredible piece. I, you know, saw it live once and then started listening to it again more recently. And like Alicia said on her episode a couple episodes ago, if you can read music, follow along with the score. It's available on IMSLP. If you like Google IMSLP Harold in Italy, it'll show up for you. It's really cool to follow along and just kind of see how everything's working together. I found it a much more enjoyable experience that way. Or maybe it's because I wasn't driving and I was actually paying attention. But the end of the piece, I also thought this was interesting. There's two violins that go off stage and a cello off stage. So there's like an off stage, if the soloist, solo viola is off stage, there's an off stage quartet that happens. And it's like, wait, what? Who's the soloist here? I mean, truly, this piece is kind of all over the place. But then there's like a big push to the end and it's exciting. And yeah, that's Harold in Italy. Highly recommend checking it out. I did like the Boston Symphony in the recording I listened to on Spotify. I wasn't crazy about Primrose. Chris, do you have any recommendations?
I haven't listened to a full recording in a very long time, but as I mentioned before, Antoine Tomastit recorded it with the, I guess it's Frankfurt Radio Symphony. They call themselves the HR Symphony Orchestra. They have like these amazing videos on YouTube of, you know, multi-camera angles stuff from their live performances. They're probably edited, but you wouldn't be able to tell. It's so good. Mm-hmm. So he recorded it with them in 2018. So everything I've heard from Tomastit is incredible, and everything I've heard from that orchestra is incredible. So there's no way that recording's bad. So
okay.
So that's probably what I would recommend. There's quite a number of recordings that mm-hmm. I'm seeing listed here, but that's the most recent. And just from a standpoint of both playing and audio engineering stuff, that's what I would go with.
Okay, cool. Do you have anything else to say about the piece or Berlioz beer?
Not really. I do wish this was performed more often. I wish it was better known. Mm-hmm. But I also wish more of Berlioz's pieces were played, because basically it's the Symphonie Fantastique and that's about it. I mean, there's like a wind ensemble piece, but that also never gets played because he writes for an insane amount of percussion instruments that you can't find. I have a feeling most of it doesn't get performed, probably because of the budget of, you know, of trying to find enough players, which makes sense. And especially, you know, with where we are now, you know, mm-hmm. it's It'll probably not. It'll be a while. Yeah. But I hope people will start programming more of his works.
Yeah.
It'd be nice to hear more of what he had to offer.
Yeah, for sure. Would you like to share where people can find you on social media or on the interwebs?
Yes. My personal website is not up and running yet, but that is in my plans really, really soon. I've been saying that for a long time, but I really, really mean it now. It's one of my many quarantine projects. I'm on YouTube. I have a bunch of my performances and compositions and arrangements of various things on my YouTube channel, which is / Chris Lowry Music. Also, a lot of my music is available to listen to on SoundCloud, which I believe it's Chris Lowry 1. I think that's right. I should know this.
If not, I'll put it in the show notes.
Sure. Okay. That works. And, I mean, you know, Facebook, Instagram, whatever, you can find me.
Chris Lowry.
Stuff. Yeah. Chris Lowry Music. Yeah. But hopefully that website will be up and running relatively soon.
Yeah. If you would like to connect more with Pour Me a Mozart, you can find Pour Me a Mozart on Facebook and Instagram at Pour Me a Mozart. Follow the page, like the posts, comment on the posts. I like interactions. If you want to share the podcast with a friend, that's free. If you tuned in to listen to Chris or listen to Harold in Italy because you're interested in Berlioz or the viola or whatever, check out some other episodes. You can also support the podcast for free by subscribing on iTunes, Spotify. You can leave a review and a rating on iTunes. Positive reviews are, you know, more appreciated, but if you think there's something I can improve on, I'd love to hear that too. If you'd like to support the podcast with some actual money, you can go to patreon.com/pourmeamozart. It's $3 a month, and I will send you a magnet that says Pour Me a Mozart. I think that's all the social media I have for that. So, Chris, your final question.
Right.
This suddenly feels like a pageant. Final question. How has quarantine benefited classical musicians?
Well, depends on the classical musician, I think. I was telling somebody yesterday that I feel like there are two kinds of musicians during this kind of time. They're the kinds that have lost everything, like all their gigs and all their income basically, and just totally shut down and or left their career and had to get another job or whatever. And then there are those who have really thrived in it. I started as the former and turned into the latter. And part of that was I had a backlog of about a year or 2 years worth of projects that I had to get caught up on, which I'm still whittling away. And it's been great because it's just kept me busy, kept me from, you know, thinking about how it looks like my career is dying. You know, it's been really nice. And I don't think I'm alone in that. I think I've noticed that musicians in general there's been kind of an onus on people to come up with ways to stay afloat for one, but also stay creative and stay relevant. Because with live music being basically dead right now, for the most part, you know, like orchestras furloughing everywhere, like National Symphony's furloughed for the next year at least. It's mm-hmm. a bunch of my friends that are completely out of work, and it's terrible. But in the face of that, people have come up with ways to get music out there in a different sense. And so like stuff like these, maybe not over Zoom, but like doing things like online collaborations of some sort. Like my trio actually is working on an EP. I don't know what we're going to call it yet, but it's all recorded in lockdown. All of us are in different places. I'm in Nashville. Our flutist Rachel is in Hattiesburg, and our harpist Stephanie is in Houston. And so we'll all record, you know, with our respective equipment. Then they'll send everything to me. I mix the audio, edit whatever I can edit, and then put the videos together. These kinds of things. And the Baton Rouge Symphony has been really, really good about providing opportunities for everyone to do these like at-home concerts. And a few of them were just like, you know, people would send in something that they recorded at home. But they did actually two Zoom concerts where like the one that I did was with several people from the viola section and cello section were doing like duos, and there was a violin and cello duo. Drago Shania did something, and yeah, just various different things like that, right? So it was all, we were all there watching each other over the internet, and donors got to pay in to watch it live streamed. Mm-hmm. And I thought, like, I was a little skeptical about it at first, but afterward I was like, even though there were some technical problems and, you know, the sound would drop out occasionally or it would get louder and then softer and whatever, or the same note would repeat over and over again like a machine gun, and then all of a sudden catch up. But besides that, it was just, it's a different experience. And I hope it's not something that is lost once things are back to normal, whenever that is. I still think this is a great way to, in cases where, like in an orchestral case, for example, where people would go to hear the orchestra and they wouldn't necessarily hear any of these individual people play on a normal basis, you know, they get to meet them and hear them and whatever in a different kind of completely different intimate setting, you know? And I feel like if anything, the level of creativity has really kind of blossomed for a lot of organizations and a lot of musicians, just watching people do things differently than what we would have thought was not just possible, but necessary. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there's a lot about this that really sucks, but there's a lot about it that's really great. And I think a lot of us have learned, I think all of us have learned a lot. And I'm really, really hoping going forward that we don't take what we have for granted and that we don't take what we learned for granted once we have everything back at our fingertips again. If that makes sense.
It makes total sense. I think, you know, I was in a couple jobs where I was feeling maybe a little burned out, and now not having that live performance, it'll be, I personally will feel really appreciative of that again. But yeah, you're totally right. It's pushed me also to figure out how to do things that I definitely didn't know how to do before.
Definitely. And another thing actually that has been really nice that I don't think is emphasized enough is rest. Like when everything went to crap, it was like what, mid-March? Mm-hmm. And as soon as everything started getting canceled, I was like, okay, well, I was booked solid from mid-March to the end of June. And then I had stuff in July and August and everything also, but, and I was actually supposed to premiere a concerto in Mexico on September 10th. And I'm kind of relieved that that's not happening because I don't want to be traveling right now. Yeah. But like all this happened and I was having some terrible tendonitis or carpal tunnel or something in my left hand. Mm-hmm. And now it's, I mean, it's not 100% better, but it's a lot better because I was forced into vacation mode basically, mm-hmm. which I haven't had a legit vacation in about 10 years. So this has been in a way kind of a forced vacation, which it took me a while to shift my perspective into thinking of it that way and kind of adapting to that. But it's been a really nice like mental and emotional reset for me.
Yeah. Totally.
And that's coming from, you know, somebody with bipolar disorder. So it's been, you know, it's been a struggle to keep, you know, a positive mentality about it. But when I've been in a positive mentality about it, it's been good. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, that's good. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah.
Cheers to you being on the podcast. Thank you for taking the time to do this.
Thank you for having me. This was really a pleasure.
Yeah, it was really fun to talk to you again after 7 years. I can't believe it's been so long.
Let's not let 7 years go by again.
Agreed. But cheers to you and the viola and Berlioz, Harold in Italy, being creative.
Hear, hear.
Hear, hear. Cheers.
Cheers. Clink.
Clink. I don't think I liked it very much before that.
That's fair.
But
I hated that piece. The first time I heard it, I really didn't like it.
Yeah.
But I was a violinist back then and I didn't know any better, so... And it's like, you can't hear those notes anymore. It's just going to sound like flatulence. But like when you put it in octaves with a double bass, it sounds pretty amazing.